From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. This is a follow-up from an earlier listener mail segment where our fellow conspiracy realist, Ryan, hipped us to a strange story about cheese in the United States. We talked a little bit about our favorite cheese commercials. I mean, some of that is clearly a genre now. You know, it's sometimes called, although I hate the name, food porn. We all know what we're talking about, the slow motion clips of like, Noel, you had a good example of a mozzarella stick. That's a classic being pulled. And then we had, you know, Taco Bell, quesadillas, quesalupas, which play a big role here. And this kind of commercial is almost a trope nowadays. And in fact, there are trendy restaurants aplenty in this country dedicated entirely to one sort of cheesy food or another. Like, have you guys ever been to a macaroni and cheese restaurant or a place that only sells grilled cheese sandwiches? It's very New York.
Yeah, there's a place I went to. I think it was in Oakland. It was called Homework or something like that. It was meant to evoke feelings of like childhood and like lunchroom stuff. But it was these bespoke kind of personal pan, like little, you know, those dishes that are meant to be put in the oven, like kind of like bakeware or whatever, like little Dutch oven kind of guys with macaroni and cheese of all different flavors and varieties. And it was obviously very overpriced for mac and cheese, but it was delicious. What about fondue? You guys ever been to a fondue restaurant?
There's a chain here in Atlanta. I think it's called the Melting Pot or something like that.
For me, it was all about the pirate ship.
Oh, Dante's down the hatch. You're Dante's guy.
Yeah. It was so good.
Seriously,
grilled cheese food trucks. Do not sleep on those.
No.
In Atlanta, there are a ton of them. Grilled cheese food trucks, guys. Oh,
So we're both cheesy and fans of cheese. So if you do not like, this is the weirdest trigger warning we've ever done. If you do not like puns, this is not the episode for you. And you should just go to the next episode. But the thing is, you know, longtime listeners, you know, I have a personal obsession with quesadillas. They're kind of a grilled cheese, I would argue. And in fact, folks, all of us here at the Stuff They Don't Want You to Know team, we all love cheese and we all love talking about food. And we wanted to make sure that was an accurate statement. So right before we went to air, I went ahead and pinged our super producer, codenamed Doc Holliday, and said, Matt and I worked on how to write this question. We said, hey, Doc, this is a work question. Do you like cheese? If so, what kind? Doc says, I love cheese, but I don't eat it as much as I would. And she kind of alluded to, you know, health concerns. But she says, I am literally the eating shredded cheese out of the bag person. So we're going to hit her with same. We're reading this on air. Sorry, Doc. So, Paul Mission Control, of course, one of the prime champions of Applebee's loves cheese. And yeah. Matt, Noel, do you guys have a favorite cheese, or are you a yes, all cheese kind of crew?
Yeah, I mean, I guess all cheeses aren't really created equal. I'll tell you what I think does get slept on a little bit is just good old-fashioned American cheese product, you know? Not even proper. I'll tell you what I like it on. Melted, because it melts beautifully, on like a breakfast biscuit. Like an egg and a sausage on a biscuit, and you just slap that cheese product on. We're going to get into this. And it just melts beautifully, and it's its own thing. And a lot of like kind of cool breakfast divey type joints do that too. But I like a I like a funky cheese, you know? Mm-hmm. I like
a little bit of a foot smell to your cheese.
I don't like don't ruin this for me, Ben. You ever had a raclette? Raclette is a one that's like a Swiss one that also has its own kind of fondue situation where you melt it over meats and stuff on this special little grill. And you drink a lot of vodka with it, which is a bonus.
Man, that sounds good.
What about you, Matt?
For my money, it's you combine, let's say, a pecan/pecan with some kind of dried fruit and a goat cheese. Mix those together with anything else, you're good to go.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Yeah.
A little chevre, right?
I'm pretty, as you guys know, I am pretty non-discriminatory when it comes to food in general. Doc says that her favorites are gorgonzola, blue cheese, and gouda. And when we were talking about this, you probably have your own favorite cheese, conspiracy realist, just statistically. But we're talking about this. We're talking about a national phenomenon. Cheese is almost a staple. Well, I'd say cheese is a staple nowadays in the U.S. And it can be weird if you travel to other countries where cheese is not really a thing. And, you know, you wouldn't see it very often in your normal grocery store or market. You probably only run into it if you went to like a pizza restaurant or something of that nature. But in different parts of the world that are historically not on board with cheese, it is still like a growing industry. So here are the facts. Before we get into the conspiracy, folks, you have to realize cheese is, as the younger humans would say, popular AF in the U.S. Unless you are lactose intolerant, unless you're vegan, or have some other dietary restriction, odds are you have consumed some cheese recently. This wasn't always the case. We'll get to it. We are adventurous cheese eaters, but if you're the average American, you know, one of your favorite cheeses, or the one you consume most often, is going to be cheddar. And there are health concerns that come into cheese consumption, but I suggest we put those to the side for a moment, to the side of our cheese plate, and look at just the straight consumption, because this is, for cheesemakers, this sounds like a resounding success story.
Oh, yeah. So if you start back in the mid-1970s, let's say 1975, you're an average American. Look at you. So are we. We are all average Americans. We consumed around 14 pounds of cheese. That's in a year. So in a year's time, you would eat 14 pounds of cheese. Now, if you went to a deli right now, wherever you are, and you said, give me a pound of cheese, that seems like a lot, right? Now, 14 of those?
Does it?
It does.
To me,
I think you typically order your cheese in maybe a quarter pounds, right? I think a quarter pound of cheese is respectable.
Hey, if you got a family, it's half a pound or a pound. That's just the way you got to go.
Okay,
I am a family.
Wow. Family of one.
Look, this is my experience, so perhaps I'm wrong. But, you know, just imagine 14 pounds. That seems like a lot already, in my opinion. Maybe that's wrong, but it's not as much as it has grown to.
Yeah, you're right, Matt. It's skyrocketed. As of 2019, and this is a number that continued to rise during the pandemic, but as of 2019, the average U.S. consumer was eating around 40.4 pounds of cheese per year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just the tip of the cheeseburger.
No, that's good. We're keeping it.
For the past 10 years, U.S. per capita consumption of cheese has risen even more, over 5 pounds from that point. And as this began to happen, we had other dairy categories that had largely remained unchanged or were flat or had even fallen. Things like consumption of fluid milk had plummeted from 247 pounds per person in 1975 to 146 pounds in 2018. which makes sense. I mean, like we talked about, I think on the cheese segment on the listener mail, you know, there were all these amazing ad campaigns, you know, to get milk back up, milk drinking, about how it's good for your bones and calcium and got milk and all of that. Now, I think most people think of milk as an ingredient rather than a beverage unto itself, like something you add to a smoothie or use in baking a cake. But it doesn't seem very in vogue to just drink milk as a refreshing beverage.
Well, unless you're a kid, you know, a lot of parents still give their children milk. Like in the mornings, sure. I give my son milk, cow's milk. And we have for a long time.
But the ability to, this always so interesting, the ability to digest lactose in adulthood is a relatively recent mutation in part of the human species, and it's far from uniform. So sometimes it's funny because if you watch television or film, you'll see the consumption of drinking milk is almost always a statement now. It's not the only time you'd see it as like a quote unquote normal everyday thing is if it's an indicator of time and place. So like our story takes place in the 1950s or something, or if it's one of those tremendously irritating breakfast scenes where there's this huge, you know, there's this huge spread and they got juice and they got water and they got coffee and they got milk. And then the guy, like the patriarch or the kid or whomever's running through the house and they're like getting calls and they look at this and they like take half a bite of toast and they're like, all right, love you, honey, gotta go. And no one mentions
you, monster. Is what right? I would say. I did all this work. I made you this continental breakfast type situation. You didn't need all that, but I did it for you because I love you. You couldn't even bother yourself to eat more than a bite of toast. I want a divorce.
Jeez Louise.
That's where that goes. But no, it's true. Milk is not nearly as popular as it used to be. I like chocolate milk. I think that still probably flies off the shelves pretty well, but it's something you put in your coffee now. Yeah. I think
I got a sideways story for you guys real quick about, you know, the urban legend or the rumor about chocolate milk, right?
That is the bad milk.
Yeah, that it's the milk with the clots in it, with the blood clots.
Oh, God, no, why would you do this to me? You're ruining everything for me.
Well, back in the day, that may have been more true than it is today. You're probably safe thanks to federal health standards. So please enjoy your chocolate milk. Also, try a Yoo-Hoo if you haven't yet. It's a good.
Yoo-Hoo is to chocolate milk what those cheese slices are to cheese. Yoo-Hoo is a chocolate drink product.
Right.
I don't think there's any real milk or chocolate in that beverage.
There's like a powder, we're inundated with cheese in the U.S. It's officially a cheesy country and a cheesy people. How did we get here? Well, there are some easy kind of fun answers. First, the popularity of cheese owes a ton to the rise of pizza. And I, for one, am grateful for the rise of pizza. I know it's maybe not the same as the legit pizza. I know it's absolutely not the same as legit pizza created in Italy. But because of pizza alone, mozzarella went from being kind of this obscure thing you'd see at a fancy cheese place to one of the most popular varieties of cheese in the country, like around like cheddar status, which is cheddar is like the Kanye West of cheese in the States.
Ben, was that an accidental pun? The rise of pizza?
No, wait. Yes. Yes, it was. Yeah. I didn't think about it.
I'm just checking one of those off the list. If anyone wants to make a drinking game out of this. Yeah, accidental or not.
We have a list of, I think we've got a mental list of puns. So again, this is going to be pun heavy. We've done some pretty serious, kind of dark episodes that we think very important. So we're recording on a Friday, folks. We wanted to do something that was not immensely depressing. So,
well, no, you're right. Just to get to the concept that cheese owes pizza a lot of gratitude, at least as an industry, as a food thing, really think about the local pizza chain that maybe you grew up with. Then also think about the big ones, the Domino's, the Pizza Huts, eventually the Papa John's and the Goodfellas and the CC's and all these other ones. When you all of a sudden you had companies that could just deliver you food, which wasn't a big thing in a lot of places, and for a lot of companies, delivering food was not a big thing, but it kind of changed the game and how Americans got food. And the other thing just to really remember here, these aren't Italian companies bringing, you know, Italian pizza that's done correctly in the Italian way. These are American companies that are creating food products with relatively cheap ingredients.
Oh, yeah.
Where they can make a ton of money on. So it's just a very different thing. We don't have to get all into pizza. That we can leave that to the Savor folks. But mm-hmm. I don't know.
Shout out to Savor.
Yeah, definitely shout out to them.
Well, but it's something we see all the time, right? This like bastardization and sort of like, co-opting of like culture and turning it into this sort of like product that can be mass marketed. And I think these chain pizza restaurants are exactly that. Because you go to like Antico's, a really awesome pizza joint here in Atlanta, or anywhere, you know, that you name your pizza joint of choice that is like a little more traditional, you know, it's not covered in shredded cheese.
No.
It has like a slice of like buffalo mozzarella, like a little circle dollop on the top, and that's what you get. And it's delicious, and it's very delicate and light, and it's not, you don't get that massive cheese pull. You get like one, but you know, again, they've got bags and bags and pounds and thousands of tons of this stuff that they're trying to ship, they're trying to sell, and it's like it is a conspiracy between big pizza and big cheese.
Well, let's step back a second before we use the C word. So let's keep painting the picture, right? Did someone who went on to found Domino's and Pizza Hut go to Italy and say, look at this, anything you can do, I can do feta? Or was this just a natural outgrowth of changing trends and taste in the American public? Did it happen as marketers would put it organically? We know that we know that pizza has also given a lot of heft to shredded cheese in particular. About $6 billion of the natural cheese category, shredded cheese. And the natural cheese category overall is a little less than $18 billion. We're talking a lot of money here. During the coronavirus pandemic, Kraft Heinz, which is a giant in the food industry, said it saw an unprecedented double-digit growth in the sale of those Kraft singles, which is, in the rest of the world, people would probably call that American cheese. It's those processed yellow cheese slices we're talking about. But pizza and a pandemic and organic taste cannot entirely explain America's weird relationship with cheese. When we look into the dawn of the American age of cheesiness, we were surprised to find there is literally a conspiracy afoot, not a conspiracy theory, not something that happened in the past. It is going on today. As we pointed out, there really is a thing called big cheese, and they're after you. What are we talking about? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsors. Here's where it gets crazy. So we've all heard of government cheese, right? We'll get to that. If you were an 80s or 90s kid, you had doubtlessly heard of this stuff, even if you never saw it in person. But when we're talking about cheese, we're really talking about milk, right? Because you can't have cheese. Well, you can't have good cheese without milk.
That's right. So let's wind the clock back to the good old 1980s, the late 80s, on the cusp of the 90s, that gray period where it sort of still feels like the one era, but things are starting to change a little bit. 1987, the median dairy farm had 80 cows or fewer. Today, that number is closer to 900. So economies of scale drive costs down and bolster output, right? So on top of that, you got the average cow producing more milk than ever before, and that is because of better breeding practices. They've kind of figured it out and honed it down to a science to get the most output for their buck.
And there are also those like heinous machines that you've seen in like some of the factory production of milk.
I like the phrase heinous machines. That sounds like a good album name.
I agree. But I think we all know we're talking about those kind of like dystopian sci-fi milk suction cup tube machines. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're talking about, Matt?
Yeah, so, and some of them are completely fine. I mean, well, who's to say? People would argue that fact. But many are less impactful on the cows than others. Some, I would use the term heinous. So, yeah, anyway.
At the very least, it doesn't seem pleasant for the animal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But as we know in our previous work on livestock conspiracies, the feeling of the animal being used doesn't often come into play. And there's also, we should also, by the way, folks, do an episode in the future on chicken farms, just chicken, the chicken industry, poultry industry in particular. It's bad, bad. I learned some weird stuff. But wait, this is our light episode. We're keeping it light. Sorry, guys. We're back to it. So,
oh, you know what it is? Yeah. Even at the cost, I mean, and it's hard to even talk about, but at the cost of the experience of the cow, the whole point of all of that production is to get more food for humans that need food. In theory,
yes.
Because it's responding to a market, right? There's a need for this milk, so we must produce more of it. How do we do that more efficiently? Oh, well, this is how. So I just put that out there.
Yeah, there is a logic. Yeah, there is a logic. The farmers weren't sitting around saying, how can we make things worse? People don't usually think that way. And you know, often, especially on smaller farms, they have a very human connection with their livestock, you know, and they want these cows to live good lives and be happy, because if the cow is in a good mental state, because it is a higher order mammal, if it's in a good mental state, then that's going to affect its diet, its nutrition, and therefore the milk it produces. We have to acknowledge at this point the dairy industry, we're talking about several years or decades ago, they were not just producing milk for a domestic consumer. They were producing it for other countries, and then a crash hit. China's economy slowed down. This drove the global demand for milk down. At the same time, the EU said they had had these domestic caps on how much milk a European or EU farmer could produce, and they removed those caps. So all of a sudden, the EU is making a bunch of milk, which means they need less from the US. Russia slapped sanctions on foreign cheese because they were mad about some Western sanctions. And then the US dollar was stronger, and that meant that American dairy farmers had to sell milk at a more expensive rate internationally. And these factors combined into this like bubbly queso dip of problems. There was a massive ongoing cheese glut. There was not a tortilla chip of a solution in sight. This did not occur in a vacuum at all historically, because if you look back, you'll see that the US government has a very long history of supporting dairy farmers when prices collapse through subsidies, through marketing campaigns, through government cheese. Maybe we should talk a little bit about government cheese, I think, before we continue. What do you guys say?
I think we should, because I, for the longest time, sort of thought it was a joke, that it was sort of a euphemism for, you know, welfare in some way. But it turns out it's a real thing. It's an actual cheese product that the government would distribute to low-income individuals and families in place of money, or as a supplement to their, you know, nutrition, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's processed cheese. It's been around since the World Wars. It was used in military kitchens during World War II. It's been in schools since the 1950s. So if you went to a public school in the U.S., you probably at some point did eat government cheese. It got it became politically charged because it was associated with welfare beneficiaries, people who received food stamps or SNAP, people who are elderly and got social security checks, and then people who visited food banks. But there's absolutely nothing shameful about that. And you know, odds are, outside of schools, we've got plenty of people in our audience today who have at some point been on government assistance. And not to soapbox too much, but yeah, you should not feel bad about it. That is what that assistance is there for. Every time you buy something and Uncle Sam takes a little vig from you at the cash register, it's supposed to go back to you in some way.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I was myself when I was a young new parent, you know, kind of getting started in my career, even before, really. I was there was a period where we were living with my mom when my daughter was born, and we got a little bit of government assistance for a brief period of time when we lived in Athens, Georgia. It was actually kind of great because they had a system where you could use those SNAP benefits to shop at the local farmer's market, and you would get 2-to-1 value for your SNAP dollars. So that was actually a really progressive, great way of doing it, I thought. And it would also support local farmers.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the good intention behind programs like this. The cheese, though, where did all this government cheese come from? That's the question. That's where we see some wrinkles in the story.
Yeah, because, was the motivation to get people who needed food more food, or was there something else behind that move?
Exactly, Matt. Exactly. So the cheese often came from food surpluses that were stockpiled by the government as part of this huge subsidy system. Butter was also stockpiled, and then it was given under the same program. But you don't hear a lot of people talking about government butter. It doesn't sound as good. Exactly. So while this program is not nefarious, it also isn't fully altruistic. Uncle Sam is killing two birds with one wheel of Parmesan here. Yes, they are feeding the hungry, but they are also supporting a massive, sometimes faltering dairy industry by guaranteeing farmers will be able to sell their products even if the actual demand does not exist. This is exactly what Matt was talking about earlier, when we kept saying in theory to each other, because in theory is not the same thing as in practice. Gentlemen, it is time for us to share with our fellow conspiracy realists the story of the Illuminati of cheese, which is a real thing. Can we say that one more time? And Paul, maybe give us a cheesy, sinister sound effect. The Illuminati of cheese. Perfect.
I thought you meant literal cheese sound effect, but we'll see what Paul comes up with. Maybe that's what he did.
Magic man.
What are you talking about? We already know where this is happening in real time.
That's right.
Genius, Paul. Whatever it was.
Yeah, we paused the recording and brainstormed about this for 20 minutes, right? So as we said, American consumption of cheese has skyrocketed, but even that skyrocketing consumption, which was not organic, by the way, has not been enough to meet demand, because we are grappling with a system that has been in place since the 1930s, since the Great Depression, when the federal government bailed out America's dairy industry with all these subsidies. And many people who are not in the dairy industry themselves are not aware of this, but those subsidies are in effect today. And part of the knock-on consequence of this is that Uncle Sam has underwritten this gigantic surplus of milk in the dairy industry that far, far exceeds the appetites of Americans. Like, we, even the cheesiest cheese lover in this country, like the number one cheese eater person, if everybody was like that person, we still would not be able to buy all the milk and all the cheese that was being produced. And when the U.S. government realized that there was this huge surplus, they found themselves in a difficult political situation. They knew that it would be, and this is something we talked about in the past off air, but, you know, during this time, post-World War II, things like that, they knew that they had two choices. They could remove the subsidies, which would lead to, over time, a reduction in the surplus of production, or they could find a way to buy this, to create a market that did not exist at this level. And the rural vote, the farmer vote, was very, very important. So imagine you're you know, a presidential administration. Are you going to go to these people who voted for you and then pull the financial rug out from under them?
Yes, and I want to give you a quick quote from a professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University. This quote comes from a video created by CNBC. You can check it out on YouTube, I believe, right now, or maybe on CNBC. But this quote is dealing with exactly that, Ben. He says that at this time in the 1930s, when these subsidies first arrive, quote, rural America presented over half of the population of Americans, and farmers presented over half of rural America. So there was this sense that as a politician, as the government, if you are helping out farmers, you are helping out a lot of citizens slash, as you said, Ben, voters.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's, and this happens a lot in the kind of political system that the U.S. has, right? You have sometimes they're vilified as being special interests, right? But you have these voters and these businesses or these institutions who have a very specific set of things they want to see in place. And at times, these forces can be relatively apolitical. You know, the name brand of the political party doesn't matter as much as their actions. So, you know, if there's a third party called the Provolone Rangers, it just gets worse. Ben, it gets worse.
My heart.
You did it. If you have that, you know, this other party and their policies are, you know, not too extreme, but one of their big things is they support a subsidy that supports your industry, then you're probably going to vote for them. You know what I mean? Or at least donate to their cause. So that's what happened. The U.S. made the decision to, and, you know, I think a lot of historians agree it was the right decision to enact these subsidies for the dairy industry and other parts of U.S. business during the Great Depression. But once you open that door, it can be political suicide to close it, to step it back. And so they continued. They continued subsidizing this industry. And now, in recent years, the U.S. dairy surplus has reached a record high. And it's been going this way for a while. The USDA quickly realized that as a result of these subsidies, they could not figure out what to do with all the milk. And so the Band-Aid solution was, I don't know, make it cheese. Cheese lasts longer than milk. And that's what they did. And so in recent years, we have, as we mentioned in our listener mail segment with Ryan, we have, as a country, generated a surplus of 1.4 billion, with a B, pounds of cheese. And you'll see all these breathless reports. If, like, go on YouTube and just Google cheese surplus. Colbert's got a great spot on it. Your local news might have done a story on it a few years ago. But you'll see these breathless comparisons because we as Americans love weird measurements. One of the ones we found was 1.4 billion pounds of cheese. That's enough to wrap around the U.S. Capitol. Nobody's saying we should consume it all. Luckily, you can store cheese. But even if the nation tried to eat all of this cheese, it's less and less likely that we could do it because that surplus is still building despite the fact that people are consuming more cheese.
Let alone the health side effects that would wreak havoc on all of us.
Well, it's the greater good.
No way. It's the thing. That's the thing, though. It's like, not to get soapboxy or anything, but like, you know, with the healthcare crisis that we have in this country, and then you start to see that all of this consumer culture that leads to poor health this lack of preventative medicine, everything's about curing when you're already like super sick and on your own death's door. A lot of it is like literally the fault of the government in the first place. This whole cheese glut thing, when you really start to drill down into it, right? I think we can think of probably a better, like, for the individual subsidized food product, like granola or something, you know? I mean, what about the grain farmers? Only need help too? But it's crazy, you guys. I just sent a link in the chat. I was just Googling government cheese and an eBay listing came up for a cardboard packaging box. It's like vintage. It's like $60 on eBay. And it says pasteurized processed American cheese donated by U.S. Department of Agriculture for food help programs, not to be sold or exchanged. it just says it all there. And it's like, it's literally helping the government. It's not helping the people that need, you know, better food.
Well, it's like helping them is kind of a side effect.
It's cyclical.
It's together. Right. Yeah. But there's nothing wrong with multitasking, you know, and if you're not hurting anybody and you're satisfying two things at once, it's understandable.
Yeah, but I would argue they are hurting people because cheese clogs your arteries if you're eating it like for every meal, and it leads to this, like, I think obesity epidemic that we have, and, like, you know,
heart disease,
one of the unhealthiest countries in the world, and I would argue that the government is culpable in that.
And on two separate occasions in 2016, first in August and then in October, the feds announced they were going to, quote, bail out dairy farmers. They were going to purchase $20 million more worth of surplus dairy products, aka cheese, to distribute in food pantries and some milk as well. As this is occurring, by the way, as this surplus is increasing, there's a global drop in demand for dairy. Plus, there's that technology we mentioned that's making cows give more milk, which results in the lowest milk prices since the Great Recession, not Depression, but Great Recession ended in 2009. This is something we alluded to in our listener mail segment. Farmers were literally pouring gallons and gallons and gallons of unsold milk into holes in the ground, 50 million gallons. That's according to the USDA itself. In an August 2016 letter, the National Milk Producers Federation asked the USDA for a bailout of $150 million. This was an ongoing, continual issue. It just kind of like would reach a crisis point, maybe go down one step and then go up two steps, down one step. It was an incremental increase. And this led to the creation of something with a somewhat innocuous name, Dairy Management Incorporated. Their website is super wholesome as a kid in the 1950s drinking a glass of milk.
Can I just say there's got to be a better way to dispose of 50 million gallons of milk than pouring it into a hole in the ground? That's going to be the smelliest hole ever. I can't imagine.
That's a t-shirt. That's going to be this.
So, yes, we're keeping it. It's true because milk doesn't have a very long shelf life. You know what I mean? And you could say, why don't we distribute this as part of an international aid or charity thing? But if you've listened to our previous episodes on farming in the U.S. and across the world, you know, farmers are often put in a very risky situation with a lot of forces that are beyond their control. So it is understandable, as strange as it sounds, that they might be in a situation where it is literally less expensive for them to get rid of the milk than it is to try to transport it somewhere and pay for the gas and pay for the storage. And Dairy Management Inc. was set to try to solve this. They were created by something called the National Dairy Promotion Board in the mid-1990s. Here's what they do. Their job is to act as an umbrella company for state and local programs promoting the dairy industry. In blunt terms, folks, this organization is a quasi-governmental organization, was explicitly created to push as much milk, cheese, butter, and yogurt as possible into products and into people, both in the U.S. and in other countries. They're the hidden hand behind what appears to be rising cheese consumption. They're the group behind Got Milk, that campaign we mentioned. Everybody remembers Got Milk. There were, it started with like some normal, you know, models, commercial actors, and then it escalated to like celebrities. And everybody would have a little milk mustache, right? Isn't that what they're called?
Yes, sir. Yep. You saw them in subway stations. You saw them in billboards. There's television commercials. It was absolutely ubiquitous. I mean, it was the kind of campaign that clearly a lot of money and marketing resources went into.
Yeah, it was direct to your eyes and ears advertising. That's what they did.
And it was era defining, too. We think of it and it like almost defines like that period in history in our minds. It's like a nostalgia thing at this point, right?
Yeah. in a weird way, they're mind lobbyists for on the individual level of people sitting there watching television, you know, which was television shows. Man, think about as especially kids watching TV shows with all of those like us. I think our generation, I mean, it is the 90s. We got hit hard with the Got Milk campaign, with a lot of the promotion of dairy products. And it formed a lot in our minds. We're going to tell you a lot of these other things that you're going to remember probably from your childhood and growing up that that this company was behind. I'm going to posit again here. I believe wholeheartedly that the Ninja Turtles television show that I watched as a child had some kind of behind the scenes interaction with this group to get me to like and want pizza all the time. I think they're behind it. I can't prove it, but I think they're behind it.
Right. And this also goes to Ryan's original question about the origin of the cheese powder used in mac and cheese. I want to pause. We've got some of our fellow listeners you're going to meet at the end of the episode on Twitter with their cheese puns of their own. But I wanted to point out this excellent tweet we got from someone who lived in Wisconsin. This is Steph. And Steph, you said, one of my favorite things while living in Wisconsin were the billboards that were just black text on a yellow field that said cheese. No other info needed. They knew why you were there. And that's like that whenever you see those really vague, this is an important point. Whenever you see those really vague commercials that are not about a specific brand name or product, they're just about a kind of thing, right? Like Got Milk is never saying, you know, go, like, it's not Greenfield Pastures milk. It's just the idea of friggin' milk.
Sure.
I love those.
The other white meat.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Beef, it's what's for dinner.
It's what's for dinner. I love those kind of commercials. You know, I want to see more of them where, you know, sometimes they're wholesome. They're like literacy movements. They're like, read books. Mm-hmm. We don't care which one.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we see this. And what DMI is doing at this time in their early days is, like you said, Matt, they're doing direct to consumer advertising. They are playing literal Bernie style mind games. They want you to be thinking about milk. They want you to be thinking about cheese and yogurt when you're in the grocery store.
Dream about it.
Dream about it.
Whoa, I guys really want some cheese right now.
Taste the dairy rainbow.
Mm.
So, I don't know why dairy rainbow makes me uncomfortable, but yeah. So something happened though in the late 1990s. People in this country began eating out more often. They were going to restaurants and stuff. They weren't cooking as often at home. So DMI did what corporate America calls a pivot, and they started working with companies that sold food to people in fast food joints, in restaurants, in what is it called? Approachable fine dining, you know, in the hallowed halls of the Chili's and the TGIFs throughout the nation.
But what about them quick food places? What do you call them?
The fast food joints, yeah.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, we kid you not, they have been infiltrated. How weird is it? They've been infiltrated by DMI. Like, think about this. If you're a 90s kid, you know, and you enjoyed Book It, you enjoyed that personal pan pizza. You probably have this memory of stuffed crust pizza in 1995.
Ugh. Yeah, and specifically from maybe you don't even remember eating it necessarily, but you'd certainly remember seeing that cheese pull and the whole notion of eating your pizza backwards. That was the whole impetus behind this. And a little old guy we might have heard of named Donald Trump appeared in some of those ads eating his pizza backwards and making it sound like, you know, I'm Donald Trump and I'm obviously a smart guy and I eat my pizza backwards because that's just what you do, idiots.
I think they cut the part where he said idiot. Yeah. That would have been funny. That would have been edgy for a 90s kid. But I think you're right. Eating pizza backwards was already this new, exciting, weird, cool thing. And by the end of the year, this initiative had increased Pizza Hut sales by $300 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but really it's about a 7% improvement over the previous year.
But still, think about all that extra cheese that went in each one of those pizza pies. And if think about if you got a stuffed crust pizza with extra cheese. Good God, DMI is just killing it here.
Yeah, they're killing it and they're killing you slowly from the inside out.
Greater good. If you eat too much stuffed crust, eventually you become the stuffed crust yourself. That's the problem. But, you know, this reminds me, I was trying to find, while we were researching this, between our listener mail and this episode, I was trying to find this tweet that I loved from a while back. It was someone I didn't know very well, but they posted this. This is kind of explicit, so Paul, please beep me. Someone said, I was on a marketing call years ago with marketing people at Pizza Hut. And this one guy said, we do what we want. Stuffed crust pizza? No one asked us about that. We just f-ing did it. And then the tweet ended, I think about that guy a lot. And I love that idea that someone is so gangster about stuffed crust. But now it makes a little bit more sense because they had help from the Illuminati of cheese. They're not the only example. Taco Bell is a huge example. Remember at the top, we said the Quesalupa is going to come into play. In 2012, a DMI operative, we could call them that, food scientist, who was probably a fantastic person. We haven't spoken with her directly, named Lisa McClintock, started working with the Taco Bell product development team. Pause here for a second, Taco Bell fans. Does that not sound kind of like a dream job?
Right.
Like you go home from work and you're stressed out and your roommates, or your partner, or your friends are saying, oh, hey, what's got you down? And you're like kicking rocks and you're like, they're just not listening with the burrito design. Okay. You don't want leakage. And I don't. And you're like, yeah, you're like, Samantha, they don't get my vision.
Think about the beauty. I mean, we've talked about it before, about the beauty of Taco Bell and Pizza Hut, some of these other places. You've got a limited number of ingredients.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But anything you can do to create a new product out of those ingredients can bring in millions and millions of dollars.
And that's like Mexican food, or at least Americanized Mexican food in general, right? Where like everything on the menu is kind of a different combination of like five or six ingredients. Taco Bell takes it to the extreme and, you know, injects massive marketing dollars into it. Ben, you were talking about what? The queso, what? Quesalupa?
Quesalupa.
There's also the quesarito. Let's not forget about the quesarito. And when you look at it on the Taco Bell website, the cheese pouring forth from it is clearly that powdered yellow stuff. Like there's not an ounce of actual cheese in this. I'm conjecturing. It's just the wrong color. It's like this kind of weird beige yellow, pale, odd color when you see it pulling apart in this perfectly symmetrical image. It also has just an insane amount of saturated fat and just more, you know, sodium than anyone should probably consume in a day. But it's absolutely true, Ben. It's genius marketing paired with this actual conspiracy and this idea we got to move some cheese units.
Yeah. So Lisa McClintock started working with the senior manager for product development, Steve Gomez, over at Taco Bell. And they said, we need to develop a new kind of cheese, a new cheese filling. A new kind of cheese, you say? Here at the Taco Bell? So, I'm at the food science lab. I'm at the Taco Bell. I'm at the combination food science lab and Taco Bell. They're stretching. So they want to make a stretchy cheese that pulls like taffy when it's heated. They want to figure out how to mass produce it, and they want to invent some proprietary machinery to make this. And the proprietary machinery is a really interesting, really clever point. So this the result of this experimentation is something called the Quesalupa. And I think the Quesarito is clearly part of this too. The Quesalupa, as we mentioned earlier, has five times as much cheese as a basic crunchy taco. Taco Bell had to buy 4.7 million pounds of cheese just to produce the shells. So that puts a dent in that 1.3 billion pound surplus. It's weird if you read interviews with people who were in Taco Bell management at the time, then they will say, you know, for the longest time, we thought cheese, sour cream, stuff like that was kind of more of a garnish or an add-on to our products. But now it's one of the main things, beef and cheese. So cheese use at Taco Bell, since they partnered with DMI, it's increased by over 22%. And that's why DMI gets this strange, somewhat like half sinister, half hilarious nickname, the Illuminati of cheese. We're going to pause for a word from our sponsors.
I don't crossing my fingers.
I'm wondering too. And we'll be back. We'll be back to explore some more unintended consequences of this, again, active, ongoing conspiracy.
Do you guys think the Bacon Illuminati worked with Wendy's when they came up with the Baconator?
DMI definitely did. And we're back. Here's the thing. There's no if, and, or but about it. DMI will tell you, if you speak with them, that their work has helped slow America's declining desire for dairy. And it's true that demand for cheese is going like this, and demand for milk is going like this.
Do that for the non-visual.
Yes. So if you look at a grid in your head, demand for cheese is starting at the lower left corner, and it's mm-hmm. going all the way to the top right. Demand for milk is starting sort of midway up your y-axis, and it's going down and to the right.
Oh, beautiful.
That works? Okay. So demand for milk has gone from 35 pounds per person in 1975 to 15 pounds today. So it's reversed. Like, what was it? Noel, I think it was you. You said demand for cheese was what, 14 something?
Oh, yeah, that's right. In 1975, Americans were consuming 14 pounds of cheese. Then in essentially the modern day, it's around 45 pounds of cheese per person per year. Milk has decreased a ton, right?
Yeah, I think it was close to 250 pounds per person in 1975, and in 2018, more like 146, so a significant decrease.
And this is effective for a lot of the stakeholders, not counting the consumers. Texas A&M economists did a cost-benefit analysis, and in 2012, they found that for every single dollar a dairy producer invests in DMI, they get $2.14 worth of return for milk, $4.26 worth of return for cheese, and $9.63 return for butter.
So, whoa!
Yeah, so investing in DMI, if you're a dairy person, this really helps. But of course, as we said, DMI has, by nature of its mission, its endeavor, they have promoted lots of saturated fat, lots of cholesterol. Eating cheese can add up. And for a federal agency that is dedicated to improving overall nutrition and giving dietary guidance, these partnerships can seem kind of like a contradiction, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And experts out there who talk about this would completely agree with you, Ben. There's a food oppression expert named Andrea Freeman, who believes that, you know, this group, DMI's efforts, quote, impose health costs on Americans generally but disproportionately harm low-income African-Americans and Latinos who live in urban centers dominated by fast food restaurants. And we've just described how these two giant, well, now one, giant chains that we at least all went to when we were younger, like my family still eats at some of these restaurants, in these fast food chains, you can see where DMI had large impacts, at least on those brands slash companies. And you can definitely see that. You can see the evidence of what Andrea Freeman is saying here, just in what we described with Pizza Hut and Taco Bell. You can really see it.
Yeah. And, you know, also farmers themselves aren't entirely on board with DMI, because some will argue this primarily helps out the big guys, the big dairy players, not the family farms or the smaller outfits. And that's a valid criticism. We see that happening with other parts of what is called agribusiness on a high level. But either way, it appears the cheesy Illuminati is real and is set to stay. At this point, we want to pass the torch to you folks. We want to get a sense of what you think, because there's a web of connections here. Is this, number one, a good idea? Is this, some of us may argue it's too much government intervention. Some of us may say it's too dishonest for the public. Other people may say, well, it is overall, it's more beneficial than it is damaging. We want to hear from you. And because we purposely wanted this to be a lighter episode and we promised some puns, we went on Twitter and asked people if they would like to help us out with some puns. So the tweet I put out, which is terrible, was, about to record this cheese episode. If you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up with your favorite cheese puns in the next hour or so. ... This will be a Gouda one.
Oh, man.
God, I hate it. I hate, why do we do this? But anyway, here are some responses from your fellow listeners.
Vaults of Xtoth, who we all know and love here on the show, says, "E damn it." As in eat them, I'm assuming. I can't think of any that would be good enough for you.
Eating cheese. No, that's not what I meant to say. Eat them? Is that a cheese?
Yeah. That one.
It's a good cheese. Yes.
And get just it smoked.
Yes. Oh, so good. But then Vaults follows up with, and now I'm getting a pop-up ad, hot cheese singles in your area. Thanks, guys.
That's great. Our own close friend and colleague that you've heard on our show before, Annie Reese, one of the co-creators and co-hosts of the Amazing Savor podcast, says, "Unbelievable. You're too big of a cheese to ask for my pun expertise now. You Munster." Spelled how you would think.
Yeah, cheese puns, you Munster. You believe you're mildly cheddar than us? I camembert being so feta up.
Oh, my God.
That's funny because there were some crossovers there between those two.
Yeah.
And then what? Our buddy Nick Tikoski did a good one. I'd step up, but I got the blues pretty bad this week. B-L-E-U-S.
Yep. And a good friend of the show, the one and only Mike Johns, who recently had a birthday. Mike is a colleague of ours, a fantastic writer, musician, and producer here in Atlanta. He says something encouraging. He says, "You've got some pretty sharp followers. You cheddar get some good suggestions here. I've got half a rind to suggest a few, but I don't want to wedge myself into the conversation."
Okay. Wow.
Okay.
There we go.
Let's see.
He kept going, by the way.
Some
of these folks are ambushed. This is one from at Grape Wanger. That's a great Twitter name, Vigil. Could we not craft less cheesy puns? Craft with a K? Yeah.
No, we can't, Grape Wanger.
Wow. Can I jump to Andy really quickly?
Please.
Andy, he said, "Ben, I believe you have enough puns for us all, but feta safe than sorry. Here's a joke. What hotel do cheese lovers stay in?" The Stilton. Oh, wonderful. My Stilton Honors Club. Can't wait for that.
And then Steph who we mentioned earlier, says, I'd make a joke about American cheese, but it wouldn't age well. Shots fired.
Wow.
Shots fired. You can find more of these puns. We'd love to hear your favorite cheese puns or your least favorite if you hate puns and ignored our warning and sat through this episode. And equally importantly, we'd like to hear what you think about these kind of things. They're part of what's known as check-off programs. We mentioned this earlier. The idea is that it is so important to have your own domestic sources of food that you will, you know, you'll go out of your way to support them more than you may some other businesses. Oh, and Jenna V says sweet dreams are made of cheese.
Sweet dreams are made of cheese.
Oh, am I to disagree?
Oh, God.
All right.
We got to get out of this, guys.
We got to get out of this. Paul, I can feel Paul groaning. Yep. So let us know your thoughts. We can't wait to hear from you. We try to be easy to find online.
That's right. You can find us on the internet, where you can also find that vintage government cheese box that I mentioned. The listing is still live on eBay if you're down for that. Just search for vintage government cheese box on eBay. I think the bid is up to around $60. But if you're looking for us, you can find us on Instagram, where we are Conspiracy Stuff Show, Twitter and Facebook, where we're Conspiracy Stuff. You can also give us a telephone call. We are 1-833-STDWYTK. Hit him with it, Matt.
Yeah, hit him with the
rules.
I was trying to think. Hey, is there a hay? Is there a cheese that rhymes with hay? Not the way. Hit him with the way. Yes, when you call, please tell us the name you would like for us to refer to you as. Doesn't have to be your real name. Could be a code name like Doc Holliday or Mission Control. Super cool. Then let us know if we can use your message on air. That's very helpful for us. Thank you. Lawyers say cheers. Then leave your message. Please only call once per subject. That would be very helpful as well. And if you've got a message you want to say personally to us, please put it right in the end there.
Quick update. Yeah. This just in. Codename Doc Holliday adds that Havarti and Gruyere are very high on her list. And I promised her we would mention that.
Oh, that's important. It's important stuff. And you call us, tell us your favorite cheeses, what you know about the cheesepiracy going on here.
Cheesepiracy!
Yeah,
you whatever. Son of a... That's perfect!
That's right. Oh, man. And if you don't want to do that stuff, you don't want to leave us a message, you don't want to find us on the internet, definitely check out the YouTube channel, Conspiracy Stuff over there. And if you have something to tell us and you want to send links or you want to, you know, really write a lot of stuff out, please use our good old-fashioned email address. We are
conspiracies@iheartradio.com.
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.